Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor and privilege to welcome to the Solari Report a woman and accomplished politician and leader who needs no introduction, and that's former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. She served her country with distinction as both a representative in Georgia and then on multiple terms, fighting her way back in again after a very interesting election that was the topic of a documentary called American Blackout. So served as Congresswoman many times. I posted one of the many videos up on the website of her fearless grilling of Donald Rumsfeld. But she was somebody who brought real accountability and transparency into government. She's been a teacher, a university professor. In fact, we're going to congratulate her again because she just got her doctorate, and she's now teaching. Anyway, we're going to talk with her about what the real issues would be if we were going to have an open and serious election in 2016. So, Congresswoman, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you on the Solari Report.
Well, it's my honor and my pleasure because, I mean, you're like the woman who gets it, and you get it so well because you've been in the trenches. You were there. You were counting the dollars. You were seeing them slip away. You were saying, you know, what happened to the money? And you saw the scam, and then you tried to teach people.
Right.
And you tried to teach people, and then they came after you. They came after you the way they came after me. So, it's like my mom told me just yesterday. Just yesterday, she said, all of the political candidates for president, all they do is they get to a certain point and then they push back.
Right.
And so I guess today we're not going to push back, are we?
Well, you know, one of the things, if you want to make me mad, all you have to say is, you know, why is nobody doing anything? And in fact, as you know, many brave Americans have done a great deal. You're one of them.
Yes.
And, you know, and that comes at a tremendous price. Because staying before we get into this campaign election, you just have to describe a little bit about what it took to come back and win again after a lot of dirty tricks that pushed you out of Congress. And it was a 2003. It was a 2003 election.
And yeah, in 2002, you can say that I earned my PhD. In electioneering, those people taught me, I mean, they showed me the book. How could they take someone who was popular at home, doing all of the right things in terms of communicating with the constituency, I had district day, so I was there. I was out there with the community. But they were still able to take me out. Well, now, they did a lot of cheating. And so, you know, but the ways in which they cheated was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. But what it taught me was that they, the powers that be, the cabals that control things and sit down and move their chess pieces on the board and say who deserves to be on the board and who deserves to get kicked off the board, or who are we not going to even allow the opportunity to get on the board, those folks will do anything to win. And
right.
The more they expose themselves, it means the tougher it is for them to win. And so they expose themselves a lot, and I got a chance to see what they will do in the offices, with the machines, the electronic voting machines. We went to court, and you name it, and I saw it. So now I think I'm better equipped than I was at that time because I just didn't understand how many tools the other side had.
Right.
But now I understand that they have tools that we haven't even begun to think about. And they use you know, without abandon. They would
right.
use them with reckless abandon.
Right.
It's just like you just have to grab your hat and get ready for the roller coaster ride of your life.
Well, for anybody who's interested, the Guerrilla News Network made a great documentary called American Blackout that tells the story of the sort of the rigging of that election, and then you're coming back and winning the next election, and it's amazing, amazing story. But then, of course, after the next term, you
right.
went on out. So one of the things I wanted to discuss was the extent to which you think foreign money was involved in those elections.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point because under the so-called McCain-Feinberg election reform, which all now is, you know, almost thrown by the wayside because of Citizens United, the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, but McCain-Feinberg, a Feingold, was heralded as campaign finance reform, but it really wasn't. And we discovered it. There was a hole in McCain-Feingold that was big enough to drive a Mack truck through it.
Right.
And we discovered it just because we were, you know, it's like the thing you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to read the regulations. And it's just like, you know, when you're in Congress, you're not supposed to read the bills, right?
Right.
So we read the regulations. Actually, it was my mom, again, who was looking at the federal election, the little magazine that comes out, and she was flipping through and she said, this is worse than before, because what McCain-Feingold had done was allowed a provision that allowed huge donors to give without any record of their having given.
Right.
So, for example, like what we discovered in my first 2002 campaign was that the very same names of the very same people gave to Earl Hilliard, who was the member of Congress from Alabama, first black member of Congress from Alabama since Reconstruction, but he had run afoul of the Israel lobby because he was going into Lebanon and looking at the weapons that were used and discovered that Israel was using experimental weapons against the people of Lebanon and, of course, the Palestinians. And so, and then, of course, he also preceded the official opening of Libya. He went there first. And, of
right.
course, that was something that was not permitted. You,
right.
even though you got sworn in, you were not allowed to be a full functioning member of the Congress. So anyway, what we discovered was that the exact same people who were on his opponent, which is Arthur Davis, were the exact same donors that were on my opponent's FEC report. And then with the changes that had been made to McCain-Feingold, what was possible was that it all could have been one check.
Right.
Divided among these names, and they were the same names that turned up in my race that turned up in Earl Hilliard's. But They, because now one person could give in the name of another person, and that other person would not have to sign a statement saying that I understand that this money has been given in my name, that is what McCain-Feingold eliminated. So
wow.
One person could give in the name of 15, 20, 30, 100 other people.
Right. Wow. Okay, so let's turn to 2016. Certainly campaign financing is going to be one of the top issues. But let's say you, as you ran for president in 2008, you were running for president in 2016, and you were free to tell it like it is. What are the top 10 issues? Let's just start down the list. What's number one?
Okay, I thought about this, and I said number one would be the reinstate the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, because I think the people are under fierce attack. I think the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, protecting the Constitution, is important.
Boy, there's nothing more inspiring than reading those two documents.
Which document?
The Bill of Rights and the Constitution.
Oh, gosh, yeah. But
yeah. It's really, once you get clear in your mind that our rights come to us by divine authority, you know, it puts it all in perspective. Anyway, okay, so I couldn't agree more. And, of course, we know the Constitution, the Bill of Rights is under siege. Okay, what's number two?
Number two is the Federal Reserve. And you know, at a minimum, auditing the Federal Reserve on a regular basis, at a maximum, discussing the full takeover of the functions of the Federal Reserve, nationalizing, I guess, you know, so it's public ownership.
Right. And I would say, as part of the audit transparency, if they're buying bonds, we need to see who they're buying, you know, if what money's going out and who it's going to. So full transparency on inside deals. Right.
And you know how, you know about that.
I don't know if I told you this. In 1998, I sent an email to every public affairs office at every one of the reserves, federal reserve banks, saying who manages your databases and do your members have access to the data in your databases? And every one of them wrote back and said, that's confidential information. So I, you know, it's the old Cynthia McKinney question. I want to know who has the contracts.
Right. That's right. Okay. Number three is eliminate dual citizens from government service.
That's a good one.
That's problematic. You know, that's very problematic. And so, you know, that could be done with an executive order. And then, you know, it's not that you get rid of certain individuals who are determined to be there performing certain functions and roles. However, the Duma did exactly this. You know, eliminating any opportunity for serving in the Russian Duma for those who had dual citizenship. So they just had to choose.
And, right.
You know, I think that's okay. So let me see. Number four, this one is interesting. Eliminate the Sykes-Picot wars from any U.S. mandate. And
so wait, say that again. I didn't hear it.
Eliminate the Sykes-Picot wars from the U.S. mandate. Basically, what I mean is the United States is participating in the dissolution of West Asia as a result of the elimination of Sykes-Picot, which is the agreement that set the boundaries for like Lebanon and all of those countries.
Right.
And now what's happening is that the United States military machine is being put to use to totally destroy all of the countries in that region so that, you know, what happened to Iraq happened to every country over there, and they are not going to stop. Those are the countries that were listed by Wesley Clark.
Right.
Seven countries in
5 years.
5 years, right. So I would stop that because that's not in the U.S. interest. That's going to war and destroying people and countries for other interests. It had nothing to do with the U.S. national interest. So that's number four. And then number five is bring our troops, our overseas troops home and put them to work on infrastructure.
Music to my ears.
Okay, then six would be diversification of media ownership because, of course, I mean, you know, it's just like too much concentration and, you know, the ownership ought to have some public service component, and
right.
We don't get that, you know. So media ownership. Seven is, nationalize all prisons, no profit off of social failure was my idea.
Okay, so I can't, you know, I don't know if you saw it, the Columbia University just announced that they were divesting all prison stocks because the students have been boycotting and picketing and whatever, but I can't tell you how important this is because the idea that the whole enforcement bureaucracy and private companies should be able to make a profit from failure is just absolutely the worst incentive system we've ever created.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So number eight is when I finally get around to the electronic voting machine. Guess who memory comes to mind? And TrueVote. You remember?
Yep.
So then nine is, honest immigration reform. And border control, not walls and not fences. So, you know, a thing and effective immigration policy.
Okay.
Border control. And then number 10, let's see, number 10 is, no taxpayer dollars for athletic teams. Because right now, the city of Atlanta, the taxpayers are subsidizing two athletic fields. I mean, it's ridiculous. Billionaires are developing, well, first of all, they're buying up important historic landmarks to put a parking lot for the football team, which is ridiculous. The whole idea of poor people subsidizing billionaires for athletic events that nobody can afford to buy the ticket to is just, I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. So that's
okay, keep going.
And then I have the final item. And the final item is that I would organize an international press conference or an international address to the people of the United States and the people of the world announcing that attempts have been made to bribe and threaten me, and therefore I will not change course, and therefore I'm calling on the people who want transparent government to join with me and protect my life. Who would threaten it?
Well, that's one of the questions. How do you, you know, we now have people who lobby with dirty tricks. I mean, we've had it for a long time, but the, you can't have a sovereign government unless you have sovereign government officials. And if they can't have private discussions and not fear for their lives or the lives of their children, how do you create conditions of sovereignty? How do you enforce against people who misbehave in this way?
Well, you know, what I was thinking is, why is it that people who are in public office and want to do the right thing never choose the public option of explaining that this has happened? Like, for example, we've got John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where he discusses Jaime Roosevelt and his relationship with these guys. And he says that he knew that they were going to be targeted. Why not allow them to be killed, but step up and prevent them from being killed? So understanding that the jackals are there because Jaime Roosevelt and the Panama president have how can I say that? So you know that they've said no to corruption,
right?
Then why isn't the next step taken, which is to make it public that they have, these attempts at corrupting them have been made, and they are calling on the people to protect them?
Right. Right, and I agree. And part of it is not just protect them from the jackals, but protect them from the smears, because, you know, the attacks are not just physical. They have... It's funny, I dealt with one cabinet secretary who used to get frustrated with me because I wouldn't break the law. And he'd say, you know, I'm going to find the dirty pictures on you. And it was really funny because one of the things I'd done during the 88 campaign was a really good friend of mine. I don't know if you ever knew him, Carl McCall. He ended up as controller of the state in Europe. But Carl was Jesse Jackson's campaign manager in New York. So he and I were good friends. So I gave $500 to Jesse Jackson. So the cabinet secretary fed that to the press, and it made me so popular at HUD. It kind of boomeranged.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. And anyway, but let me get back to some of the money issues, if I could.
Uh-huh.
Because one of the things I would love to see is the federal government produce audited financial statements. But more important than that even is place-based financial statements. So, you know, if you're running from Atlanta, Georgia, I would love for the people in Atlanta, Georgia to get copies of the federal budget pertaining to Atlanta, Georgia. Because it's a lot easier if I drive around, you know, I always tell the story when I was assistant secretary, I'd get the list of all the foreclosures in a place, and I'd go to that place, and it said that I had 10 foreclosures there, and there was an empty lot. So there's a kind of accountability that can occur when citizens have the data on the money that relates to their neighborhood or their city or their town or their county. And I would love to see a lot more done in the federal finances to help citizens bring accountability and better performance to the money. Because as you brought up infrastructure, one of the things we need to do is, if you look at all the corporations making profits on war right now, we need to get them into making profits on something more productive.
That's right. For example, Lockheed Martin, what I learned while I was there is that Lockheed Martin is making all of these death machines, but Lockheed Martin is also involved in counting our votes. So now...
Oh, no!
They are. So, or at least they were, anyway.
Uh-huh.
Why not allow these companies, just as you have said, to transfer their knowledge of making war to making things that people actually can use
right.
and live with?
Right. Another thing I wanted to bring up was privacy of communication. You know, so as we need transparency of government and government money, I think we all have the right. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't believe that any of my digital communications are private. And I think that there's all sorts of governmental and corporate entities that have access and use that data in a way which is not to my advantage. And frankly, I think that is terrible for the economy. It's terrible for trust. You know, it's great for the police state, and it's great for rigging stock markets, but I just think it's created a tremendously unhealthy culture.
Well, Catherine, here's the thing. You know, I used to believe, it's like, I guess I took the Kool-Aid, right? I used to believe in the government. I used to believe in the efficacy of the federal government, and maybe
right.
because it was... the Supreme Court that was giving these decisions about desegregation, and you know, so that was like important to me. And so, yeah, we can trust the federal government, but this is not that federal government, or maybe it always was that federal government, because you know, I've read the pages of the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program documents, and I've read the Senator Frank Church Intelligence Activities Select Committee report on intelligence activities against United States citizens, as
right.
well as how these activities were utilized against foreign leaders. So
right.
I know what the government is capable of doing. I have a much better... And, you know, here's the other thing, is that we have to personalize it, too. It's not the government, which is this great, big, huge, amorphous thing that we can't exactly put our hands on. There's individuals who are charged with making decisions. And it is those individuals who move this massive apparatus in one way or another. And it is...
Right.
those individuals that we have to speak, and we have to be willing to call their names. Like, for example, it gets me into trouble, too, and it probably got you into trouble as well. But the relationship of certain individuals, like, for example, you know, on U.S.-Africa policy, you look at Maurice Templeman, and you go back and you say, oh, wow, my goodness, from... hiring the fellow who ended up being the CIA station chief in Congo, who was riding around with Patrice Lumumba's bones in his truck, and I mean, you know, to dating Madeleine Albright, and she shows up with all these huge diamonds in her ear.
Uh-huh.
You know, these relationships, these are individuals
right.
who are a part of, and that's why. I was so delighted to have Peter Dale Scott on my dissertation committee, who helped me to understand the role of the deep state. There are individuals who are inside and outside of government service,
right.
say, but who are able to move this huge, massive military machine in ways that you and I as... Even you and I as undersecretaries and members of Congress cannot do.
Right. And because we know the civil service is not running the government, so to speak, you have.
That's right.
And I always tell the story when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, then I was lead financial advisor to HUD. I would be ordered by either the secretary or when I was a contractor, the assistant secretary, to go get data that they were required by law to look at in the process of their program responsibilities. And the lead contractor who controlled all the data would refuse to give it to us. So, and when I was assistant secretary at Lockheed Martin, you know, I would ask him for the data that I was required by law to look at to have fiduciary responsibility for $300 billion in mortgage insurance. And Lockheed Martin would just say, no, you can't have it. You know, it's quite astonishing. And so, you know, the government is not in control of the government.
That's right.
Right.
Right. And the people are, you know, sort of the last. Now, I also believe that there are, it's sort of like tiers changing on the deck of the Titanic.
Right.
In 2008, I read a very interesting report that came from Malaysia. And I wish I could find it now. I can't find it. But there was a gentleman who did some research on who actually are the financial elite, the majority shareholders in U.S. financial houses.
Right.
What he found is that prior to 2008, there was one set of players. And then the so-called crisis happened, but the crisis was a crisis of opportunity, right? So you moved.
Well, I would say, yeah, I would say the crisis was a coup.
Was what?
A coup. I call it the financial coup d'etat. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And so then you move in a new set of players. And so now the occupants of the chairs on the deck of the Titanic have been changed, but that was the coup. It was the financial coup. So now we've got Wesley Clark, who has announced to us that there's been a policy coup. And
right.
We've got Catherine Austin Fitz, who has demonstrated to us that there's been an economic coup.
Right.
As well.
Right.
Now, the people have to understand what has happened to them. And,
right.
I'm a Southerner, right? So
right.
I can talk about race. And race without really being like, you know, all uptight about it.
Right.
I just wrote this piece about the Confederate flag because, you know, everybody's talking about the Confederate flag and all that. And so I said, okay, if we're going to talk about the Confederate flag, and I talk about Georgia, my home state. But then I say, well, you know, let's also look at the values that are associated with Old Glory. Let's talk about the stars and the bars and the Confederacy, but let's also talk about the fight.
Right.
What are the values that are represented there?
Right.
So, anyway, what I say, well, in this piece, I also say that it is Southern white men who get the issue of race far better than the folks up north.
Right.
It's been shoved in the faces of the Southern white men, and they confronted themselves.
Right.
Anyway, I say to these white men that I get a chance to talk to, Southern and Northern, I say to them, you guys genocided the indigenous people, and you trafficked the African people, and in the process, you created and built a whole country that became the most powerful country on the planet.
Right.
And yet, now, you lost your country, and not even a shot was fired. What is that? So on my Facebook page, I just recently posted the photo of the sniveling coward Ashton Carter, and I say, look, I can't even believe that your ancestors are the ones that conquered the world. I can't believe it. because they're bent over like towers of jellyfish with no backbone at all, dancing to the dictates of the unseen hand that is now in control of U.S. Economic and military policy.
Well, that's the question that I keep coming back to. Who's really in control? And, you know, the one thing I'm very clear on is part of, you know, it's murky and there are lots of different factions and interests. But let me go back to the sort of campaign issues. One issue I would love to see is that the U.S. intelligence agencies stop having all the reporters and the academics on their payroll. So, yeah. I just think right now the policy apparatus of this country is not a policy apparatus. It's basically spin doctors on the payroll, you know, of the wrong people. And so, you know, we need to get back, whether it's integrity of the media or integrity of the policy discussion. You know, we need a policy discussion that's more than pit bulls on the wrong payrolls. Or if somebody's taking money, which is fine, it's fully disclosed. You know, if I'm reading an article, I want to know that guy gets $100,000 a year from the CIA.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, you know, when I mentioned in my number 6, diversification of media ownership, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Right.
In fact, you know, it was the Church Committee report that were a result of the courageous actions of some folks, some like hippies, who actually broke into the FBI office and found this treasure trove of documents about the counterintelligence program, which then sparked the need for the Church Committee. We don't have a Senator Frank Church in the country today.
Yeah.
We don't have these bills passed unanimously in the Senate, or by one or two votes in the House. When I was there, was always me and Ron Paul. We were the two no votes on the board.
Right.
Now, in those Church Committee reports, the CIA acknowledges that it acted illegally against its charter inside the United States. And one of those ways that it acted was with journalists being on its payroll.
Right.
That, of course, now we have an entire Department of Perception. What is it? Management, perception management in the Pentagon. So now you know that the situation is even worse. Now, so in the 60s, you have the 70s, you have the revelation that, yes, we have journalists on our payroll. They not only had journalists on the payroll, they even had preachers on the payroll.
I can believe it. I'll never forget sitting in church in 1998 and hearing that they were going to put out grants to all the churches. And the White House was going to have an office of of religious, I forget what the call. I said, oh, great, they're going to buy all the churches. Because they, you know, the grassroots churches had too much power and credibility. And they were slapping money out to them. It was, you know, one church I used to go to got a big HUD sign. And I said, this is really bad.
and of course, then everyone, you know, these people know how to play on your ego. Because you can't be satisfied to have a little church that's fully paid for. You got to put all of your members in hock to a private bank and get one of these mega churches, because everyone deserves to be a member or the leader of a mega church, right? So then, of course, the independent church that was able to express itself and protect its members is now in hock to the very people who have shifted U.S. policy. This is, you know, this is not just a situation of happenstance. This is by design.
So let me.
So the pastors cower in, I mean, you know, they're just like the guy over in the corner with his arms raised and he's quivering and shaking because he can't say one word out of line because
right.
if he says one word out of line, he's going to get, you know, his mortgage on the church called in.
Right. So let's talk about the economics, because right now, if you look at the way that the U.S. dollar operates, you know, the U.S. dollar really operates as a global taxation system, but it works and depends on force. So if we do all these wonderful things and reduce the force, do we run the risk that the dollar starts to fall dramatically?
Well, now, you know, when it, this is the part where I don't have the answer for that.
Right.
And so then that's where you get like-minded advisors who come in and say, okay, we are going to have an economic revolution where the value of our money also actually – let's talk about the value of the money. The value of the money is nothing as it currently stands, right? Except what can be extracted from people and exacted on people as
right.
a result of the military that follows it. But
right.
how about, like, for example, I'm over here in the region and I haven't had a chance to look more closely at this, but you've got the King of Bhutan who has said, well, let's even measure our economy differently. Let's measure our economy based on people's happiness. So he calls it the Growth National Happiness Index. And so, yeah.
You know, I call it the Popsicle Index.
Okay, so yeah, so let's undergird the value, well, actually, in the first place, our currency should be something that is a public instrument. You know, I subscribe to the Ellen Brown theory, and I'm not an economist, even though I took a few courses, so that makes me an expert, right?
Right.
But first of all, ensuring domestic tranquility and happiness, and then actually having an economy that's based on real value and real product as opposed to these financial schemes. Nobody's going to tell you, well, it's here.
Right.
Hillary.
Well, there's no doubt you can re-engineer the economy to create dramatic amounts of new wealth if you will make some of these reforms. There's no doubt about that. Let me turn, because you've been traveling a lot in the Middle East, in Asia. You know, you've really traveled the world, and I would love to know what you think the perception of the United States over the last 10 or 20 years and how it's changed. What's happening to the United States' image and brand and authority around the world?
You know, I'm deeply disappointed in the United States. And I also have to, when I say that, I mean both the people and the government. The people inside the government, the average citizen, and because, you know, by now there should have been an uprising, you know, honestly. And people, I've been grappling, even though this isn't directly a response yet, but I've been grappling with this notion of to what extent are the people of the United States guilty for the crime, guilty and responsible for the crimes committed by the United States government? And so I would have to say that in one way, we are not only responsible, yes, we are responsible for the actions of our government, but in many respects, we are also guilty.
Right.
And so therefore, what is our responsibility toward change? And so what I'm teaching my students is that we all have to assume responsibility for the actions of our government, and when the government actions deviate from our values, then we have to assume a public political responsibility to act on behalf of change. And to the extent that our people are not doing that, actually doing that, what is the extent of our complicity in those crimes? And I think that extent becomes very high. What made
right.
me think about this was I was in London at a lecture. Sir Gerald Levy, I believe is his name, who is a leading, I think he's a member of the House of Lords, and he happens to be Jewish and used to be a Zionist. And in his remarks, he said that based on the votes of the last election, not this past election in Israel, but the one before that, where approximately 76% of the population voted for Likud or Livni's party,
mm-hmm.
that the people were complicit in Israel's crimes. And I've thought about that ever since. He made some very, very strong comments about Israeli voters. And so then I said, okay, well, if it applies to Israel, it also applies to the United States. And so December 2014, United States State Department made a report available to the public that was 19 years late. And in that report, the United States admitted that Dwight Eisenhower signed an authority to kill Patrice Lumumba, which was the first time a U.S. president had actually authorized the murder of a head of state. And not only that, but $100,000 was set aside for the purpose of accomplishing the deed. And so I put on my Facebook page, how can the people of the United States repair the Lumumba family, and what can be done to repair Congo, which has not been able to recover
right.
from this act. And the responses I got were very, very interesting, because the people of the United States who were responding were saying, well, you know, that was the government, that wasn't me. I'm not guilty. I don't have any responsibility. It wasn't my fault. You know, I wasn't alive back then. And so there's this whole area of denial of responsibility
right.
that has to be tackled.
Right.
And I don't know how deeply that goes, but I know on that particular issue, I was shocked and stunned by the response, but also grateful for the responses that I got, because it let me peer into the way some people are able to live their lives in complete oblivion to the reality and the ramifications of their own behavior. So,
well, you know the red button story, don't you?
No.
Okay, so all the subscribers have heard the red button story, but I'm going to tell it again because this is right at the heart of the issue. I was giving a speech many years ago to a group of people called Spiritual Frontier Foundation International, and they have a conference once a year to talk about how our society can evolve spiritually. They're very committed people. very nice people. And I was in the middle talking. I've been asked to talk about how the money works in organized crime and the intersection of dirty money with Washington and Wall Street. And I was talking about the CIA here, or the congressional hearings on this, on the Dark Alliance allegations in 98. And the Department of Justice at the time had told a reporter I was helping that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all illegal funds, including narcotics profits. And so I said to this audience of 100 spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in, you know, dirty money, including narcotics trafficking? And they said, well, you know, we'd have problems financing the government deficit, and we'd, you know, that money would go to Singapore and Hong Kong and London instead of the U.S. And so the stock market would go down. So I said, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. And if you push that, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your city, your town, your country tomorrow, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to a trillion a year, plus the accumulated capital thereon. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our IRAs and 401ks to go down. We don't want our government checks to stop, and we don't want our taxes to go up. So I said, what you're saying is you want the CIA to continue to market narcotics to your neighbor's children.
Yeah.
So, and what, you know what I discovered that day though, was that what needed to happen was not for them to push the red button. What needed to happen was for us to have an honest conversation. Because if we could have an honest conversation, then we could turn the red button green. We could make money pushing the red button, because you don't, you know, it's not profitable to liquidate your human and intellectual capital, your cultural capital, your spiritual capital. You know, liquidating your entire society is not profitable. And so there's a way to turn it around, but it's complex and it requires really talking about, okay, how does the money work and how can we turn this around? And, yes, you know, it was really funny. I live in Tennessee in a very segregated county. And when I first got there, I kept trying to get people to collaborate about getting the local money changed around. And finally, you know, everybody was so committed to hating each other. And I said, you know, if you guys would just collaborate about the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor. Anyway, but that, you know.
And so that's very, very instructive, because you see, we have been programmed to hate certain people.
Right.
And what that program hate allows is for those people who are stealing the money to keep on stealing.
And right, but remember, I come, you're a youngster. I come from a generation where, you know, John Kennedy started to talk about love, he got shot. Malcolm X started to talk about love, he got shot. Martin Luther King started to talk about love, he got shot. Bobby Kennedy started to talk about love, he got shot. And what we all learned is, if we talk about hate, maybe we won't get shot.
Yeah. And so I've always said that we need to have a conversation about who we are.
Right.
And what the United States actually stands for. What
right.
are our values?
Right. And you know something? I think that brings us back to the first thing you said. I think one of the most healthy things that could happen is everybody in America sit down and read the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States and say, okay, now what does this mean to my life and how I conduct my life and my values and how I relate to you and my friends and my neighbors?
That's right.
Right.
That's right. We need that, and we need to be led. Of course, now, you know, I just got this PhD in leadership and change. The whole point of leadership is to prepare the context for having the tough discussion about change. There will be, as we are, or our society is constructed now, there are winners and losers.
Right.
And we have to understand that things are the way they are now because those who are the winners want it that way. And
right.
So as we manage people through this change, we also have to address that some people who are now winners might actually become losers.
Right.
But we have to figure out a way to minimize their losses.
Right. So what you right, you want to create a process. It's funny, I sat down and I said, what is our current wealth compared to what it could be if peace had a chance? And I figured the current wealth is less than 1% of what is possible, just optimizing what we have now. So there's plenty for everybody if you can find a way to collaborate and cooperate and compete without violence. So plenty of competition. Right. So there's plenty for everybody. You know, we don't have to get into a spiral down of stealing each other's pies. There is a way to get into, you know, when I worked at HUD, the cabinet secretary, one of his favorite quotes was to quote Luis I can't pronounce his name, Marin, the Puerto Rican leader. And he said, when I was young, I was a revolutionary and I wanted to redistribute the bread. And now I'm old and I want to help people build bakeries.
Yes.
So you know what? You go.
Go ahead.
You go.
Well, thinking about imagine ancient man, and I've given some thought to, like, you know, the whole people have been reaching out to me and telling me, oh, you need to learn about Tesla and you need to learn about this and learn about that. So I try to study the stuff that folks send to me, and imagine ancient man looking at the stars and moon and the sun and realizing the tremendous power of the sun and what the sun actually gives us. It gives us our life. It gives us everything. But yet, somehow, we got constricted in our thoughts about energy.
Right.
There's only one source of energy. And so,
right.
You know, so now we are at the point where wars are energy policy. And I just say that there's so much abundance out there if we just look at our environment in a different way. And if we look at each other in a different way, there's
right.
as resources as opposed to competitors.
Right. Right. But we're going to have to start practicing the golden rule. And from a cultural standpoint, that's a very big change for us in the United States. You know, because we've been on the central banking warfare model for 500 years, and changing that is a very deep change.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would like to follow your idea about the state of Georgia. And I don't know how to get started on that, but if you could get me started on that, I would love to make that a part of my talking point, because,
okay.
You know, I'm sure I saw one of your speeches where you talked about this massive, you know, the Ross Perot talked about the giant sucking sound.
Uh-huh.
It's the intelligence apparatus of the state. This giant sucking sound is sucking off trillions of dollars for doing things that the people of the United States know not what.
Right.
And unfortunately, too many of us don't care as well what it is that they're doing until it's on our doorstep. I remember reading just this week that a woman is walking around in her house nude, which she has a right to do. And the policeman peers through the window and busts into her house and arrests her.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, my God.
It just broke this week.
Oh, it's not funny. Ugh.
You know what? I also have the nightmare of the thought of, because, you know, the life you and I lead, the thought of me squatting at, like, a mosquito and the darn thing has a camera in it.
Has a what?
Because a camera.
Right, because right.
Now, you know, we've got the Pentagon's got these mini drones, and they can show up in many different ways as a fly on the wall, monitoring your conversation.
Well, you know, I hate to tell you that Area 51, I was just listening to a new audio on Area 51. They were working on bird drones in the 70s. So, yeah, so imagine what's now. Well, Cynthia, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Soleri Report. Can you give us any hint of what you're planning on teaching? I'd love to know what's in the future for Cynthia McKinney and how we can be a part of it.
Well, I tell you, I'm here, and I'm nearing the end of my, they don't know that yet, but I'm nearing the end of my commitment to Bangladesh, and so I'm contemplating the future, and I am always open to suggestions from your very deep-thinking followers, and you, of course, who understand the real deal and what actually.
Well, if you were going to teach, because I think you know you're a wonderful teacher, whether you're being a political leader or a university professor, but if you were going to teach, what part of the world, if you could teach anywhere, where would you teach?
Well,
if you could teach anywhere.
Here's the thing. Part of it is, after having been targeted in the way that I was targeted by the people who targeted me, who, as you very well know, are among the most powerful people on the planet,
yeah,
they have a way of strangling your financial or economic opportunities,
right,
and shrinking the world in which you are able to operate. Now, what I am learning is that after having been targeted in such a way by the most powerful people on the planet, that there is life still. And
so,
itself, I think that is an important lesson for people to see and understand that you can be targeted and you can still live.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And I would say it a different way. You can, because, you know, here's the interesting thing. You know my situation. I went through 8 years of, or 11 years of litigation and all sorts of audits, investigation. Again and again and again, my skin was saved by honest government workers. You know, I have to tell you, the civil service saved me every time because there were so many honest people. And it's what one wonderful friend of mine says, they're allies everywhere. So that's what I find, because, you know, I think there are many people who won't do things as fiercely and publicly as you will, but they'll certainly sneak around and depend and support you and watch your back. You know, a lot of times in ways we don't even know. It's quite astonishing to me. So, you know, the scripture says just stand. And, you know, what I found is when you do stand, all sorts of forces show up to help support you when you
That's
do.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
that's right. Thank you for reminding me too, Catherine. Thank you so much for reminding me of that.
Oh yeah, no, it's always amazing. You know, I'll just have to close with one little story. When I was in the Bush administration, I was ordered by the higher ups to rig an administrative court case against the former regional administrator in the New York region, and I wouldn't do it. I said, I'm not going to destroy somebody's career. I'm not doing that. And in fact, so when I left the administration, I called her up and said, listen, have your attorney call me. You know, I'm happy to testify. And so sure enough, I showed up and testified. And the poor general deputy took one look at me and then realized he had to tell the truth, too. And she got off, you know, she was free to go and live her life. And then, you know, when they came after me, they tried to get the auditor They'd asked the auditor in the IG's office to do an audit, and the auditor came back and said, look, they're clean as a whistle. They did a great job. And so she was ordered to switch it, and she wouldn't. And then she had to leave government, and a couple years later, she gave an affidavit to my attorney telling the whole story.
Wow.
So you know something? What goes around comes around.
Well, I'm waiting for that full circle.
Well, Sid,
I just have to say to you that it is such an honor for me to talk to you. I believe that you are the smartest woman on money that I have ever met in my life.
Well, you know something? If you become president, I will be your Secretary of Treasury.
Let's work on it, baby.
Okay, well, Congresswoman and former House of Representative and presidential nominee Cynthia McKinney, you have a wonderful, wonderful day. Keep us in your thoughts. I'm going to have you in my prayers, and you keep me posted on what I can help you do. Get to your next university professorship with excitement and the spirit in the land, okay?
Okay, will do.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.